You're listening to audio from the 2023 Liturgy Collective Conference, a gathering that fosters rest, connection, and growth for church musicians, pastors, and worshipers. For more information, visit liturgycollective.com.
My name is Tim LaCroix. I am a pastor in upstate New York, and I'm also professor of historical theology at Covenant Seminary. I teach ancient and medieval church history. So Kevin and I are tag teaming, and we're going to cover the entire 2,000 years of church history in 25 minutes. So I'm going to cover the first 1,500, and then he's going to pick it up. So, yeah, that's what we're going to do. I have a thesis. My thesis is that flourishing Christian movements have two key aspects. One is that they are exilic. They come from a place of exile. And the second is that they are churchy. So what do I mean by exilic? We heard a great summary of that from David just now. By exilic, I mean either they come up from the roots by people who they are not sitting in the seats of power. They usually have some power, otherwise they wouldn't be able to reform anything, but they are not the ones in charge, or they are a part of a minority of some sort. And as I studied church history and look at the reformations, plural, throughout church history, I see that all of these flourishing movements are exilic in some sense. And the second is that they are churchy. And what do I mean by churchy? I mean, they do the stuff we do at church. They read scripture. They pray. They sing. They teach people to do those things. They preach and teach, and they participate in the sacraments. And all of these happen with the people fully engaged. Congregational or popular participation is a feature of all of these reformations or flourishing Christian movements throughout history. So they are exilic and they are churchy. In order to give you an example of this, I am going to talk about something that is apparently on the mind of every American male, and that is the Roman Empire. I thought that would go over. I thought you guys would laugh at that. So, we have a story about the fall of Rome. And there's a couple things you need to know about the fall of Rome. There's a couple of sort of myths about the fall of Rome. One is that Rome didn't fall. It simply moved east and continued to exist until the 15th century. What really happened was that the influence of Rome faded in the west. Rome was no longer the capital of the empire, and its influence faded, and its military support faded. And so what you have happening starting in 410, when Alaric sacked Rome, is that you have a decline of Roman influence and Germanic peoples migrating and filling the void. These are properly called the Germanic migrations, not the barbarian invasions. That's very pejorative a way to look at it, especially since many of us are of Germanic descent. What we have is an infilling of people, and these people that are infilling are either pagan or they are not Nicene Christian. They are Arian Christians. They don't believe in the full divinity of Jesus. And so all of a sudden, the churches, which were largely centered in urban areas, find themselves in exile. Now, the plan for navigating exile, it was laid down by two people. We can include a third as a part of this, but the main architect was the North African theologian and pastor, St. Augustine of Hippo. He laid down the theological, the liturgical, and sort of the philosophical foundation for a new civilization. Augustine was still alive. He lived well into the 5th century when when after Rome was sacked. And so he saw this coming, and he cast a vision for what this new world could be. He wrote a book called The City of God, which lays out this program, and he also wrote other books such as De Catechizandis, that's hard to say, De Rudibus, The Catechization of the Roots. It's all about education. It's all about formation, theology, etc. And then we have Benedict, who takes Augustine's theology of grace and applies it to the monastic life. Now, you may not think of grace and monastic as going together, but if you read the Rule of Benedict, it is heavily influenced by Augustine's theology of grace, the fact that we are sons and daughters by nature of our adoption and that we depend on the grace of God. And so Benedict's rule is very important because it does two things. First of all, it emphasizes the grace of God so that performance does not become necessary for the Christian life. It is an outflow of grace. And the second is he moderated monasticism to make it doable. So he lessened the requirements of fasting. He increased the amount of food that monks would eat. This is all in the rule. He decreased the amount of prayers they would pray, and so that they could live lives other than simply being monks and nuns. We'll just give you one example. The Eastern Desert Fathers would pray the entire Psalter once a day, like every day. And Benedict reduced it to once a week, right? Later it was reduced to once a month, and now we do it every 6 weeks, if we do it at all. But that's much more doable. And Benedict says in his rule, I aim to give you nothing burdensome, nothing too hard to do to create a school for the Lord's service. So Benedict is very important because he enables this this class of Christians who've devoted their life to prayer and work, ora et labora, work and pray. And this sets the foundation for what Europe would become. And so the architects of this movement are found in Augustine and Benedict and also of Gregory the Great, who we can thank for being able to get out of church in time to make it to the restaurant because he greatly lessened the length of the church service. I want to talk to you about some people that followed. The Carolingian Renovatio, you may have heard the Carolingian Renaissance. It's really more of a reformation. They called it a renewal, but I call it a reformation. In this environment where Christians find themselves isolated, they are in urban areas where, this is the second myth about the Roman Empire, it didn't fall because it continued to exist in urban areas all throughout Europe where there were churches and there were schools, there was Latin language and culture, and especially important Greco-Roman education. These continued to exist all throughout, even past what we would call the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And there was a family that came on the scene named Charles. You may have heard of Charles the Hammer, his son Pippin the Short, his son Charles the Great or Charlemagne, his son Louis the Pious, and his son Charles the Bald. This five generations, this family only really remained in power for five generations, but the program that they, along with their pastors and theological advisors, laid down would become the foundation for Europe. One scholar, Rosamond McKittrick, she calls the Carolingians the family that forged Europe, and Charlemagne is known as the father of Europe. Their program has the characteristics that I just described to you. It is exilic because it inhabits this space where they find themselves surrounded by many peoples who aren't Christian, and so a prime goal and a prime aim of the Carolingian Reformation was to send out missionaries to reach them. So missionary endeavor is definitely a part of it. But also the other churchy stuff that I described to you. There was a document that was written. It's actually a piece of legislation in the year 790 written by Charlemagne and his court called the Admonitio Generalis, or the General Admonition. This is a fairly long document, a piece of legislation, but toward the end, we have the program for Reformation where we see the foundation laid by Augustine and Gregory and Benedict put to feet in this context. And I'm not going to read all these out. You can glance up there and especially see what's underlined. What we see is that teaching is very important. This may not be what you think of the Middle Ages, but this legislation dictates that all the bishops and all the priests and pastors should understand their faith, that they should disseminate through their parish ministries so that people understand what their faith, their baptism, so that the prayers that they say, and don't get thrown off by the word mass here, the prayers they say at church, they understand what they're praying, they understand why they're praying it, that they are preached to, and by the way, preaching was done in the vernacular language, even if the liturgy was in Latin, so that they can understand it. It says so that all can understand it. And here's a key, that they sing the service. It says that all will be able to sing the Gloria Patri and the Sanctus in the service. So the thing that the Carolingians brought back into re-emphasis was congregational participation in the liturgy, singing the service, understanding the service, etc., understanding the prayers, so that it was not just simply a mental exercise. Another thing the Carolingians emphasized in another piece of legislation is that the people had to stay at church until the benediction, because it had become practice that they would just wander off at some point. Some would leave after the reading of the lessons. Some would leave after the Lord's Prayer, but the Carolingians said, no, you need to stay to the end so you can hear the sermon, and this is most important, so you can take the Lord's Supper. The Carolingians emphasized popular participation. When I say popular, I mean the people. Participation in the sacrament on a regular basis, weekly at least, and that they partook both in bread and in wine. And so reception of the sacrament as a means of grace has always been an emphasis of every Reformation that you will look at in history. And it was certainly the case of the Carolingian Reformation. Here we see that the Catholic faith, and Catholic faith refers to the Nicene faith, that which is according to the whole. That's what Catholic means from the Greek word kata, holos, according to the whole. That it be diligently studied and be preached to the people. They were to make schools for boys. This is not only a way to train people for service and ministry and also in government, but also a way to engage in mission as they created schools on the mission field. They were to learn how to read the Psalms. They were to learn how to chant and other subjects. And so we see that liturgy is a big part of what they were doing. The clergy were all to learn Roman chant. That's what we know as Gregorian chant. And orderly proceed through the nocturnal and the daily office. And so the emphasis was that there were all the clergy and all the many, many, many monks and nuns were to pray and pray and pray. There's an article written by another scholar named Makey DeYoung, and it's called Carolingian Monasteries, Powerhouses of Prayer. And what she argues is that it had these monasteries all over France and what we know now as France and Germany, and they were committed to praying for the king, praying for mission, praying for the people, day in and day out, seven times a day. And if you think this sounds like it's too separated from the people to be a part of what I talked about, that it is exilic and popular, I would say two things about that. The first is that many of the churches, if not most of the churches, we're in the monastery, so the people are coming to the monastery for church. So they are hearing these things and learning these hymns and learning these psalms, and over time they are participating in it. This is something that they would participate in. And the second thing you need to know about the Middle Ages is that people didn't have a lot of free time. Because of because technology had not advanced as far as we have, people had to have very specialized vocations, and so they pretty much only did one thing. You were a farmer or a sheep herder, or you were a prayer. And so there's a large class of educated religious people, people committed to praying, to singing, to doing ministry and vocation, and that is what the monastic classes are. But they were devoted to prayer, and they chanted through the Psalms day after day. So to sum this up, Carolingian theology is churchy. It involves bringing the liturgy to the people and bringing the liturgy to bear on mission and life. It is sacramental. Understanding and participating in the sacraments was a major part of this. The very first book that was ever written on the theology of the Eucharist was written by a Carolingian scholar named Pascasius Radbertus. It was education. Alcuin of York established the educational philosophy, you might say, for the Carolingians and emphasized that everyone was to be taught. That's what's behind what we just read about everyone being educated. The monastic life, as I just talked about, emphasizing that monks are to be engaged in ministry and mission, being pastors, pastoral care, and missionaries, all in the places that they were seeking to spread the word. And missions is a big part of that as well. And what's interesting is, though, even though this family only had power or rule for about five generations, the footprint that they made, the foundations that they laid, would be the basis for which Europe was built and continue to have a lasting influence even until this day. Every university or college you step in is because of the Carolingians. They laid the foundations for the world that we live in many ways. But what happened? We move from exilic perspective to Jerusalem perspective because this was so successful a plan that the church and the people, the European civilization, became rich. It became decadent. It had much power, and in the church itself, over time there was creep. And the way the church, you can understand why it was done. These beautiful cathedrals were built, and they were glorious, and they were full of light. The liturgy was beautified with more and more singing that was more specialized, and you had to have trained choirs. And over time, it becomes something that is moving away from the foundations that were laid down by Augustine and Benedict and the Carolingian scholars. And that is, it includes the people. And the holiness of God was emphasized by these great, beautiful liturgies and these wonderful cathedral spaces. But the holiness of God also led people to feel like that they weren't worthy. And so they stopped participating in the Lord's Supper to the extent that by the time of the Reformation happened, people, the average person would probably only commune once a year. If that. And so what we have is a story where once again the faithful are back in exile because they, the people that are longing for God and longing for reformation of the church are not able to pursue it by the means that they have in front of them. And so that sets the table for the next 500 years. And I'll pass it over to Kevin.
Thank you, Tim. So, where do we go from here? Well, as Tim said, as we come to the Reformation, once again, we have this position, this situation, where worship in many ways is spectator worship, where there isn't significant congregational involvement. We've departed from that, as Tim just mentioned. I certainly can't give a whole history of these 500 years. I'm just going to focus on a few vignettes, some things that I think are helpful, illustrative, maybe inspirational for us. So I'm going to start with Martin Luther and the success of the Reformation, quote unquote success. And I'll talk about a book with that very title here in a second. I love this quote from Philip Schaff, the great church historian. He says, "To Luther belongs the extraordinary merit of having given to the German people in their own tongue and in a form eclipsing and displacing all former versions, the Bible, the catechism, and the hymn book, so that God might speak directly to them in his word and that they might directly speak to him in their songs." It's hard to overemphasize what a revolution that was. Robin Lever, in this book, The Whole Creation, The Whole Church Sings, a wonderful book to understand the importance of music and the Reformation, says this: "The Reformation may have begun in 1517 with the 95 Theses, but it can be argued that only after 1523, when the hymns first began to appear, did it really begin to take hold. Early on in the Reformation, Luther recognized the importance of not just translating the Bible into vernacular German, but of revising the liturgy and the songs used in the liturgy as well. You're going to realize both Calvin and Luther come into situations where they've got to figure out how can we involve the congregation in singing. They're both in situations where they have, well, Luther has a choir. He doesn't want to throw everybody out of work, but he also wants to involve the congregation in singing. Calvin, by the time he gets to Geneva, they've stopped singing in church, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But he issues a call, Luther does, for German poets to help in the work in the early 1520s, and he began to do it himself as well. Actually, the first hymn, or it's really more of an anthem that Luther wrote, the impetus for it was when he received word of two teenage boys that had been martyred in Brussels. We don't sing that one, at least in my churches, because it names those two boys by name. So it's not necessarily a universally helpful song maybe today, but it's worth looking at. But here's what he says in the preface to the 1524 hymnal, which contained only 8 hymns. So, but it's a start. Here's what he says. In order to make a start, to give an incentive to those who can do better, I have, with the help of others, compiled several hymns, namely 8, so that the Holy Gospel, which now by the grace of God has arisen anew, I love this, may be noised and spread abroad. Do not diminish the importance of small beginnings. Do you know how many German hymns there are now? Maybe 100,000. So from 8 to 100,000, it's pretty remarkable. The next edition of that hymnal published later that year had 25 hymns, 18 of them by Luther. He himself wrote maybe 36 hymns. A century later, this is a really fascinating book, Christopher Boyd Brown, Singing the Gospel, Lutheran Hymns and the Success of the Reformation, where he argues that you can trace the places where the German Lutheran Reformation stuck versus the places where it was wiped away by persecution, almost maps exactly to the places where singing was introduced. It's a fascinating book. But he says this, nearly a century after the beginning of the Reformation, the Carmelite monk Thomas Ejesu, who's not a fan of Luther, in case you didn't know, marveled at how securely Luther's hymns had planted Lutheranism in Germany. The German Jesuit lamented in 1620 that from the Jesuit point of view, Martin Luther had destroyed more souls with his hymns than with all of his writing and preaching. And yet we often, like Dr. Chappell said, think of preaching as the main thing. And we think of preaching as what changed the world. It's always been bigger than that. And then we come to Calvin. I've listed a few places here if you want to study this a little further. I won't say much at all about Calvin other than this. In 1537, he and Farrell present 4, quote-unquote, non-negotiables to the city council regarding the reformation of the church, and it includes singing of the Psalms in French. At this point, they're not doing that. Luther, or Calvin hasn't yet experienced this, but he's convinced that they need to try. Here's what he says. We are unable to compute the profit and edification which will arise from this, singing the Psalms in French, except after being experimented. We got to at least try it, guys. Certainly as things are, the prayers of the faithful are so cold that we ought to be ashamed and dismayed. The Psalms can incite us to lift our hearts to God and move us to an ardor in invoking and exalting with praises the glory of his name. But it's soon after this that he and Farrell are kicked out of Geneva. At this point, when he issues that 4 non-negotiables, he's theoretically committed to the idea of psalm singing in the vernacular, but he has yet to experience it. But all of this changes when he goes to Strasbourg. Here, he hears singing in Martin Buther's church and begins his work in finding French metrical psalms for his people to sing. And he actually publishes the first Genevan Psalter while he's still in exile in Strasbourg. The 1542 Genevan Psalter, or Genevan Liturgy, he says this, singing has great power and vigor to move and inflame men's hearts to call upon and praise God with a more vehement and burning zeal. It's not what a lot of people think of when they think of Calvin. They don't think of passion. They don't think burning, vehement zeal. They don't think he's complaining about people's cold, lifeless prayers. But that's because they've not usually read Calvin directly. The 1562 Psalter was the most gigantic enterprise ever undertaking in publishing until then. The call for sung psalmody was one of Calvin's first acts of liturgical reform and one to which he was dedicated throughout his life. That's John Whitfield from his great essay in his book, Worship Seeking Understanding, that you all should have and read. Now, one of my themes that I always like to remind people is so many of our preaching heroes, particularly in the Reformed tradition, have devoted significant time and effort to curating the church's song. They've not farmed it out to other people. They've taken it and involved themselves deeply in it. I mean, we certainly know about Luther and Calvin. If you didn't, you know, maybe in the last 5 minutes, you now know a little. Well, we know about the Wesleys, and we know about John Newton. But how many know that people like George Whitfield, Charles Spurgeon, J.C. Ryle, Archibald Alexander, the first professor at Princeton Seminary, Philip Schaff, the church historian, all of these men published hymnals? All of them. And yet we don't really think of them that way. We don't reprint those books. We preprint books of sermons. Even in biographies that we read about them, you rarely will hear about how important singing and curating the church's song was to their ministries. I'll include one other that I didn't have a chance to put there. Another kind of exile of sorts is the exile of the sick room. And if you've never read Charlotte Elliott's The Invalid's Hymn Book, I think that's another way to even think about a type of exile, to be exiled to the sick room. And what can you do? How can you serve God there? This is Charlotte is the author of Just As I Am, but so many other wonderful hymns in this hymn book that she edited. And then I want to give one more vignette because we're here in Nashville, Tennessee, right? And just down the road from Fisk University, the Fisk Jubilee Singers and the Negro Spirituals. This is a picture of the original Fisk Singers. If you've never been to Fisk, you can go over there and look it up. They have a little museum, though it's closed on Saturday, so I'm not sure how you'd be able to get there during the conference unless you skipped out on something, which I don't recommend. Just a couple things about this. Where did these songs, these Negro Spirituals, come from? Several things kind of all converging together. West African musical culture, religious practices, and particularly the call and response feature of West African music and the ring shout, which was a controversial thing, and even in the black church community. I won't say more about that now. The Bible, and of course we know that certain things were allowed to be given to the slaves, certain passages and other passages were kind of kept from them, and yet it seems that the slaves were able to get other parts of the scripture, even that their masters didn't want them to be able to see. And you see the spirituals begin to resonate with some of the stories, particularly Israel and oppression and Pharaoh. All these things that they weren't supposed to read about, they read about, they resonate with, and you begin to see these images show up in the spirituals. But also Isaac Watts and the Psalms and the camp meeting. Isaac Watts, Samuel Davies, Presbyterian, sometimes called the Apostle of Virginia. He gave many copies of Watts hymns to slaves in Virginia. And that practice of lining out psalms and hymns resonates, it seems, with the slaves in the West African call and response culture. And so there begins to be this amalgamation of it. What the early black church did was make this style of lining out their own. And many of the spirituals have references to bits of hymns from Watts. And there is even a whole tradition in the African-American church, which you've never heard, I encourage you to seek it out, called the Dr. Watts tradition. It's not always, as a matter of fact, sometimes it's not hymns by Dr. Watts himself. And yet it is a particular way of singing in the black church that you just have to experience in person. This sort of undulating kind of sound that musicologists struggle to even know how to notate. Finally, improvisation. When you think about exile, I want you to grab hold of this and think about this. Improvisation is a way of life for oppressed peoples who must make do with what little they have. I don't know if you've ever read Rodney Clapp's essay in his book, Border Crossings, entitled That Glorious Mongrel, How Jazz Destroys the Heresy of White Christianity. Provocative title, I know, well worth reading, and particularly thinking about what does it mean for a church in exile, in a post-Christian world, to approach the way we are in the world more as improvisation than merely proclamation and assuming that we are the dominant culture, because it's not the reality anymore. And then James W. Work, a Fisk professor, writing in 1915, in this little book you can come see afterwards if you want a little show and tell. In 1915, he claimed to actually be able to trace the origin of a few of the spirituals. It's remarkable. He tells the story of Mrs. Sarah Hanner Shepherd, in quote, "In whose heart was born, swing low, sweet chariot, and before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave." And there they are. Incredible to read about this. Finally, Frederick Douglass, who preached a must-read sermon address on Psalm 137, our conference theme text, entitled, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" Something I try to read every 4th of July, and I commend to you. He said this about the spirituals, looking back. He said, "I have sometimes thought that the mere hearing of those songs would do more to impress truly spiritually minded men and women with the soul-crushing and death-dealing character of slavery than the reading of whole volumes of its mere physical cruelties. I did not, when a slave, understand the deep meanings of those rude and apparently incoherent songs. They told a tale which was then altogether beyond my feeble comprehension. They were tones, long, loud, and deep, breathing the prayer and the complaint of souls boiling over with their bitterest anguish. Every tone was a testimony against slavery and a prayer to God for deliverance from chains. The hearing of those wild notes always depressed my spirits and filled my heart with ineffable sadness. To those songs, I trace my first glimmering conceptions of the dehumanizing character of slavery. I can never get rid of that conception. Those songs still follow me to deepen my hatred of slavery and quicken my sympathies for my brethren in bonds. If anyone wishes to be impressed with a sense of the soul-killing power of slavery, let him go to Colonel Lloyd's plantation and on allowance day, place himself in the deep pine woods, and then let him in silence thoughtfully analyze the sounds that shall pass through the chambers of his soul." Finally, I say this, truly thus did the poet and hymn writer William Cowper, who took up the attack on the slave trade, by the way, before either John Newton or William Wilberforce was engaged in it, through his poetry. In a letter, he said this, "It is a noble thing to be a poet. It makes all the world so lively. I might have preached more sermons than Tillotson did, and better, and the world would have still been fast asleep. But a volume of verse is a fiddle that puts the universe in motion." Never diminish the importance of the songs we sing in exile. Yeah.